Change is complex and difficult, no matter the context. Although sometimes they may be overly simplistic, change management tools are plentiful and can help someone kickstart the process of making change happen. Now, culture change is doubly hard. The simple approach has been to impose strong cultures. But several episodes of this podcast and the main Talking About Organizations podcast have shown the several downsides of trying the strong culture approach. So is there another way? My name is Tom Galvin, and these are my reflections on management. So what we're talking about in this episode is planned culture change. And I want to describe it, and I'm going to use Edgar Schein's model of culture, although really, you know, any model of culture will do. Schein's model is built sort of in a pyramid in which you have the shallower aspects of culture, which are tangible, visible. They're the artifacts. That's the things that anybody can see. When we're talking about culture change, they're aimed at trying to change the artifacts of culture. But underneath it, almost like an iceberg floating in water, you have the norms and the values sort of in the middle, and then at this huge bottom of the pyramid, which are the underlying assumptions, is the term that Schein uses. It's basically what the individuals bring into the culture, how they view the organization, how they view themselves in the organization. When we're talking about planned culture change, we may only be influencing the artifacts because that's what is there and is tangible, but it's an expressed intent to change attitudes. And it doesn't take much to see how difficult that can be. I mean, we have lots of examples of where espoused culture changes only really changed the artifacts of culture, the rituals, the ceremonies, the habits and the practices, maybe even the structures. Not necessarily with actually causing people to think differently about themselves or about the organization. An example of how culture change by imposing strong cultures having a very negative effect on the organization was explored in the main podcast in episode 47, when we looked at Gideon Kunda's tech culture. And this was an example of an organization that really tried to shape everybody's attitudes about what constituted sufficient commitment by members to the organization, which is to say rather total, totalitarian, really. And all of the efforts, all of the actions that it that took, all of the activities that it took to try to enforce that strong culture and what it did to the members. We certainly, in the dialogue that we had on that episode, certainly united, I would say, in opposition to that approach to culture change. However, in some circumstances, perhaps in times of crisis, where you really do need sort of a strong response, a strong organizational response to get the organization out of the crisis mode and to ensure the organization's survival, some aspects of that type of a strong cultural approach may very well be useful. But that's not to say that everybody would want to work in such a place. Especially to me, I question the idea of using what I would call an instrumental approach to culture, of viewing culture change as the pulling of levers or the tweaking of variables, and presume that they will change behaviors, deeper attitudes, senses of members' commitment. I want to give an example of a text which perhaps when I think about planned culture change and I think about how culture change occurs in an organization, I think this is a text that can get that risks sometimes of being misunderstood. And this is one that's quite probably hailed as one of the great examples of successful culture change. And this is Lewis Gerstner's Who Says Elephants Can't Dance? The book was written in 2003. It chronicled his efforts to lead IBM from the brink of failure and regain its competitive advantage in the computer business. At the beginning, the company is suffering badly because it's stuck in the mainframe business, the mainframe computing business, while the whole industry is moving onto personal computing. He finds complacency. He finds destructive internal competition. And a company that's basically doesn't do anything because it's trying to analyze everything too much. It doesn't show initiative. His efforts, you know, the whole book is about his efforts to change the culture towards one that rewards innovation, that encourages better teamwork, and acts with speed, shows greater speed in decision making. And the outcome, the culture changed and IBM turned its fortunes around. That's fair enough. You know, that is exactly the sort of a good news story that, you know, we should pay attention to and we should think about if we're serious about trying to change our own organizations. But of course, because it is a data point of one, it's an anecdotal story, albeit a very powerful and well-conceived one. It's unique. And even Gerstner himself in the book conceded that it might not be replicable everywhere. So it didn't stop people from trying. But I think sometimes what it does is it actually kind of gets misread into a way of saying that, well, if we repeat what he did, we do the same types of activities, then we should be able to achieve the same kind of results. The reason why I think that this is a fundamental misreading is because, of course, Gerstner, in a few hundred pages, is trying to capture what occurred over the course of a much, much longer period of time. And that required considerable amount of personal persistence on his part. I mean, that's, you know, take the story at face value. That's one of the big takeaways that I had, was the amount of energy it takes to try to drive the change, to change attitudes. Sometimes we do get trapped into looking for sort of the shortcuts. We may be shortcutting the process by thinking about trying to replicate the activities, trying to find those neat little levers and knobs that we want to manipulate in order to change ultimately attitudes. So what I've tried to do is look at, you know, where else can I draw some ideas from organizational development? And a particular concept or construct that I've come across that I find really useful as kind of a metaphor for culture change, which I think applies well to the Gerstner example, and I think applies to just about all the instances of culture changes, successful and unsuccessful, that I've either witnessed or been a part of. And this is this comes from Andrew Van de Ven and Marshall Poole. It is what they refer to as a motor of change, which is to say that they surveyed a wide range of change theories, and they found that there were basically four motors. These are motors you can combine together to produce a broader, more complete theory of change, or a broader strategy of change in an organization. But one of the motors I found to be really useful to try to describe, well, how does culture change actually work in practice? Let's remove the planned part, but let's talk about culture change as it actually works in practice. This one motor of change that Van de Ven and Poole described is called the teleological motor. And just as sort of like a, you know, a basic metaphor for how it goes, you have your current state, you have a desired state or goal or something that is, you know, that basically is what you want. And the change is driven by dissatisfaction. That's their term, was dissatisfaction. There's a delta between where you are and where you want to be. And so then you do something and then you assess that and do it again. If you were to think of that motor, you know, in an instrumental fashion, you could think of it as like striving for compliance. Let's say you have information security training that you want to make sure that everybody who's using your computer systems is complying with security policies. And those security policies have to be trained. People have to know what those policies are, how to apply it, what to do if they find instances of noncompliance. Okay, so your current state is 0% trained, and your goal is 100% trained. You do an activity, you train one quarter of the organization, and so then you move to 25% trained. And then you say, okay, what are things about the training that went well and went badly? And then you do it again. You're up to 50%, and you keep going until you basically achieve what you want. That's a, 100%. So that's kind of like the instrumental approach. Of course, everything I just described only talks about training. It's only at the artifacts level. No guarantee that we've changed anybody's minds about the importance of information security. You hope so, but it's not necessarily going to be the case. What I want to do is I want to talk about how the teleological motor really works. And a much more accurate example of how the teleological motor works is the typical person coming off of the winter holidays feeling a bit out of shape. And they come up with a New Year's resolution. They're going to get back in shape, lose the weight that they gained, do all of this stuff, and get ready for their summer vacation. They want to get back into the bathing suit they wore the previous year. Okay, what happens? We've got the current state. We've got the desired state. The individual is now going to start the diet, the exercise program. Perhaps does it for a week, does it for 2 weeks, has some initial success. The first couple of pounds come off. Maybe they feel a little bit better. But then what happens? They decide, I need to reward myself. I've done really well for these 2 weeks, and that ice cream sundae looks really good. Or, I don't feel like exercising today. I think I'll skip a day. Maybe a few ounces, maybe a whole couple pounds come back. And so then there's a little bit of a regression. And then, we're going to renew the efforts. Maybe lose a couple of additional pounds. But then something happens at some point. You start to run up against the actual, physiological aspects. The body starts to rebel and you plateau. You seem to be doing well. And then all of a sudden, no matter what you do, you can't progress any further. You might even go so far as to like double your efforts, like do something extreme, like, instead of doing a simple exercise program, you do something, you double the effort. And then what happens? You risk getting injured. And then the goals change. Here it is, perhaps March, and you didn't make as much progress as you wanted. And now you're injured. And instead of wanting to get your beach body back, now you're just concerned about walking again. In some cases, you might actually find yourself in a worse position than you started. Despite the diet, despite the exercise, you might actually end up in the program actually having gained weight. Your dissatisfaction is greater than when you started. When you think about that, of course, that motor of change, there's a lot of change going on, but it's certainly not a lot of what you would call progress. But that explains, that is precisely how a lot of culture change actually happens. It's two steps forward, one step back. Perhaps a bit of frustration. The goal is still out there. But the goals change. I talked about the instance in which you get injured and your goal may change. Well, sometimes the goal of culture change moves because it's a stakeholder's view or somebody else. The leadership changes and they change the goal. It doesn't have to be a great change, but it could be enough to cause confusion in the organization. It's almost like a dance going back and forth. So then when we put the planned in front of culture change, if this motor is what really describes the way that culture change, just ordinarily occurs, how do you put a sense of direction into it? Part of the answer, I think, is to have a body whose responsibility it is to govern the process. So you have to have a very strong, and in the military organizations, we call them offices of primary responsibility. There's a doctrinal term for it. But you can kind of understand it's like the proponent. It's the ones in charge who are trying to usher along the culture change by collecting and analyzing the data to ensure what is the delta, the current state of the delta between where you are and where you want to be. And to prescribe the activities that move, that basically turn the motor forward and then reassess. The data that's collected really does have to capture what are the changes in the attitudes. Because again, the leader, the organizational members, they can see what changes of artifacts are happening. It takes a lot of energy to really measure it in terms of attitudes without impinging on the organization's mission. It's that energy, you know, that direction of energy that I saw as I read the Gerstner book, that it took a lot of persistence. It took a lot of energy to try to get people to change their minds and to see that what he was talking about, what he was wanting the organization to do, was beneficial to the organization. The thing about culture change, you know, when we think about things like eradicating sexual harassment or expanding the organization to, or changing the organization's identity, those changes in attitudes require a considerable amount of energy to keep them on track. Because people in the natural course of transition are going to get frustrated. They're going to give up. They're going to not understand, or you know, they'll approach things half-heartedly. That office of primary responsibility has to be in a position, has to be postured, resourced, in order to do that oversight governance function, to help the leader make the culture change happen. If you want to kill culture change, I am convinced the surest way to do it is to basically eliminate or marginalize the Office of Primary Responsibility role. Don't give it the resources. Don't give it access to the data, or make its operations so cumbersome or ineffective. You know, sometimes when an organization, you know, puts an initial energy into a culture change, and then over time, they start to get tired of it, get tired about hearing the messages about their, you know, about how they got to change their attitudes. And of course, not everybody, you know, has the energy to spend on that. There's competition for everybody's energy. And so then if the energy isn't maintained, then the whole thing can start falling apart. Two steps forward, one step back. Oops. A problem, changes in goals, and the motor's humming along, but we're not seeing progress. Sort of to wrap this up, I think we really do need to have culture change efforts, but I think we have to take a realistic step back and say that the imposition of strong culture from above is just... There's too many limits. It may achieve some short-term goals, but if we're talking about, you know, lasting culture change, where changes in attitudes, it takes an intense amount of energy, and it has to be resourced. It has to be made a continuous priority of effort, and ultimately, it has to there has to be ways to show how that's going to improve the organization's performance. And clearly, you know, the use of the organization's values as the basis is going to be helpful. Otherwise, culture change is going to feel like spinning wheels. We're spending a lot of energy, kicking up a lot of dirt, but not going anywhere as quickly as we think we should. And that's all for now. The views expressed are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Army War College, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.